Welcome to Your Family's Health. This is Joan Buckley from the Department of Nursing here at Nassau Community College. Your Family's Health is a program that focuses on healthcare issues and the resources available to you here in Nassau County. On the show, we speak to experts from around the country to keep you up to date on current healthcare issues and trends. And today, we're going to be speaking to Dr. Adi Sharmar. He's the Chief Medical Officer at South Nassau Communities Hospital in Oceanside. And we're going to be talking about identifying risks and recognizing signs of a stroke. So, if you want to know more about how to stay healthy in Nassau County, stay tuned for the next half hour to 90.3 WHPC, the voice of Nassau Community College. So welcome to the show, Dr. Sharma.
Thank you, Joan. Happy to be here.
Yeah, we're very excited to have you here. And a lot of times I think listening audiences need to know a little bit about how you even became interested in looking at strokes, making things better for strokes. So can you tell us just a little bit about your background in medicine and how this became part of something that you're crusading for?
Certainly. So my background emerges is in emergency medicine. I'm trained in emergency medicine, which is basically for physicians who work in the ER. And as you know, they have to be able to handle anything that walks through the door, which includes stroke. And about 10 years ago, I became the director of an ER, and New York State decided that stroke was being misdiagnosed, undertreated, underrecognized by the public, and they really wanted to push a campaign to not only increase awareness of stroke in the public arena, but also to streamline and protocolize the treatment within hospitals. So they created the Stroke Center Protocol. And at that time, I was chairman of a large emergency department seeing about 100,000 visits a year. And I became involved in stroke because we were intimately involved with the state getting all of those protocols into place, making sure that we were providing the highest level of care for our patients.
Now, just what is a stroke? I mean, people hear about it all the time, and I know it's a cerebral vascular accident, and instead of a heart attack, I've heard and seen signs for brain attack. So, but what really is a stroke?
So that's a great analogy. The brain attack is probably the best way people can understand it. When a person has a heart attack, the blood flow to the heart, one of the vessels of the heart is cut off, and that causes that heart attack, and it can be fatal. Similarly, when a person has a stroke, a blood vessel in the brain is cut off, so the circulation to the brain is no longer functioning, and the brain needs that circulation for both oxygen and glucose. That results in brain tissue dying. Depending on the size of the stroke and the area of the stroke, it can be anywhere from mild to fatal. So it's also important to think about brain attack the same way you would a heart attack, that you need attention quickly, and that there's a very small window of opportunity for healthcare providers to render treatment before that issue becomes permanent.
Now, with the heart attack, everyone knows, you know, call for help, call 911, start compressions, that kind of thing. What should someone do if they think that there might be something going on? Like, what would someone see, for example? What would someone see in a family member that says, you know, something's not right?
Right. That's actually very important for people to understand what the symptoms of stroke are. And they are so varied, again, depending on where in the brain the vessel is being blocked. But basic symptoms are numbness or tingling of parts of the body, weakness, especially weakness, facial drooping or inability to speak. But they can also be something as simple as a severe headache that you don't usually get, a dizziness that's not resolving and vomiting with that dizziness, confusion. So it can be almost any symptom because it is the brain, so depending on where it is. But those are the major symptoms. Weakness, numbness, and slurred speech or a drooping face are the most common symptoms that we see of people with stroke. And then occasionally dizziness, severe dizziness, can be both vertigo or a stroke, but there's no way to tell, especially if it's the first time. So it's always better to be safe than sorry and have it evaluated.
So do you often get family members, or not family members, but people, patients, come into the ER that have had, you know, recurring headaches or just a nagging headache for a couple of days, then they've gone to their primary care? And do they then come to the ER for those follow-up tests? Or do you think that a lot of it's taken care of on the outside? And then,
Right. You
know, you get two kinds. You get the real, in the emergency room, facial droop, arm weakness, leg weakness, that kind of thing. And then there's some subtle, it sounds like it can be subtle.
It can be very subtle, Joan. And there's two types of strokes. We should make sure people are aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
The easiest way to describe them is wet and dry. A dry stroke is when there's a blood flow blockage, so basically that part of the brain is not getting blood. A wet stroke is when a blood vessel leaks or ruptures, and that causes bleeding into the brain. So we typically call that a wet stroke. Those wet strokes are the ones that most commonly present with headache. And typically they're described as the worst headache of your life. So for patients who have regular daily headaches or frequent migraines, they are well accustomed to that pain. They know what that pain is. They can tell you without any doubt, oh, this is my migraine or this is my chronic daily headache. Those are not the patients who have to worry about a stroke. It's the person who doesn't have headaches on a regular basis or the person who has headaches and knows their headaches well, who now has a very different headache. And for the person without headaches who has a severe headache, a mild headache is typically not a stroke. So if somebody has anywhere from a 5 up to a 5 to 7 out of 10 headache, take some Tylenol, they feel better, that's not typically a stroke. It's the person who has a pounding headache that they've never had before. That's going to be concerning for what we call wet stroke or a hemorrhage.
You know, it's funny that you said it just like that, because what I think of is someone that I wouldn't normally expect to come up to me, like a family member, and say my headache or anytime anything's really wrong. It just stands out to me that it's something that needs to be addressed. So, and this, like you described it, is perfect. The worst headache in your life, and it's just something that you can't focus on afterward. It just becomes all-encompassing. So it's definitely different than a regular Tylenol, take two Tylenol and rest a little bit headache.
But
what you mentioned even dizziness and things like that. Is that what primary care, like when you go to your doctor and they ask you if you have any dizziness and stuff, do they start to look at the risk factors possibly? Like what are the risk factors that people should be aware of?
Right. The risk factors for stroke are the same as the risk factors for heart disease, essentially.
Oh.
First and foremost, there is some genetic components that you have to be aware of. So especially with the wet strokes, arterial venous malformations, we call them AVMs for short. Those are genetic in terms of you're born with them, and if one person in your family has them, you have a higher predisposition for having them. Those are aneurysms or bubbles in the blood vessel that leak, and they can cause that wet stroke we talked about. For dry strokes, it's the same as a heart attack. If you're a smoker, if you have high cholesterol, if you have a history of having family members with vascular disease, whether it's heart, limbs, or brain, all of those are risk factors. And so essentially, if you want to reduce the risk of stroke in all individuals, healthy diet, exercise, and routine health maintenance are ideal for prevention.
Now, is there a greater incidence of stroke in, being that you're talking now, you're comparing it to heart disease, I think women are moving up on the scale, but is there a greater incidence of a stroke in a man over a woman?
So similarly, there is a protective effect of estrogen.
Okay.
And so just as in heart disease, younger women are protected from heart disease, but once menopause occurs, the risk increases significantly. Generally, our stroke population is in a more senior age group. And by senior, I don't mean 80 or 90, just meaning above 50, let's say. So for that reason, there's...
Above 50? I'm sorry. Above 50.
Right.
Oh,
we'll
boy.
We'll call those seniors, but not senior citizens. We'll just say
okay.
Senior compared to junior. How's
okay.
That?
That's good.
Okay. So it's like sophomore and freshman. The patients who are 50 and above, there's roughly a 1-to-1 ratio. It's slightly more in favor of men having strokes. So, again, that male predilection is there. However, it's close enough that I wouldn't say women are immune to having strokes.
Right. Now, hypertension, I know that's something that I've always thought really puts you at high risk for a stroke. But then you mentioned that the wet stroke, right, would be that slow leakage. And I imagine then that if you have hypertension that's not controlled by either diet, exercise, or medication, then would that put you at a greater risk for a wet stroke?
Absolutely, for both types of strokes, actually.
Okay.
So severe hypertension that's not managed is a risk factor for both types of stroke. When hypertension is undiagnosed and goes untreated, then the risk for both a heart attack and a stroke are elevated because the vessels are getting damaged from the high pressure that's being applied to them. The scary thing about hypertension is that you don't feel it until it's too late. So that's why when I mentioned routine health maintenance, that's critical for preventing all sorts of complications of health-related disorders, especially hypertension, which can go undiagnosed. Now, once you have hypertension, you're diagnosed with it, then it's critical to maintain accurate and compliant treatment with whatever protocol you and your healthcare provider come up with, because it's easy to say, oh, you know, I can skip my medicine today. I don't feel any symptoms. But it's really one of these things where if you don't stay on top of it every day, you don't know when your pressure may spike. And very, very high blood pressures are associated with an increased risk for that wet stroke we talked about, so that hemorrhage. So certainly if you are a person with hypertension, you want to maintain your blood pressure in the normal range as close as possible. And even borderline, if you are under some extra stress around the holidays or at work or family, that's okay too. It's when the systolic, the top number, goes around 200, we start to worry about a risk for a bleed.
Wow. So do people come into you sometimes and the symptoms was there at home, and then they come in and now the symptom's gone, and then they're there for a bit and the symptom comes back? Is that uncommon with a stroke or one that's, evolving?
That's actually a great question. There's two answers to that. There is a type of stroke which is called a TIA, a transient ischemic attack. And people used to call that a mini stroke. What that is basically there was a temporary interruption in that blood supply. So this is always a dry stroke, the mini stroke. It's a temporary interruption in blood supply. The body was able to take care of the issue. And so you had symptoms of a stroke, but because it was temporary, the blood supply resumed and your symptoms resolved. Now, the interesting thing about that is that the issue there is, one, it's a warning sign that you are definitely at higher risk for a future stroke. So that's concerning when you see that. The second issue there is that the risk associated with a recurrent stroke is based upon not only the symptoms, the duration of symptoms, but your blood pressure presentation. There's a very, very strong algorithm that's been developed to risk stratify patients. So there's actually, it can happen within 3 days, it can happen within 30 days, it can happen within 1 year. So those types of warning strokes are very, very important for people to catch early. You know, many times the symptoms resolve in an hour, so somebody thinks, oh, I'm better, I don't need attention.
Right, right.
That's where you can actually have the most impact, because you can prevent a future stroke by being put on the right medication, by having the right diagnostic test, and making sure that there's nothing that it can be easily fixed by a simple procedure to reduce your risk.
Yeah, I know my mother in her sophomore year or her early older numbers, she had a TIA, and she always referred it to as her warning. You know, oh, I had a little warning, you know, that kind of thing. But for her, and I'm sure for a lot of people, it was an eye-opener. And she really did start to look at her medications and, you know, the response of them and how she was doing with her blood pressure. So I think sometimes those little warnings, and that's a good term because it does make people aware that they, you know, things change in our bodies. You know, this is a perfect time for a break. So you've been listening to Your Family's Health on 90.3 WHPC, the voice of Nassau Community College. This is Joan Buckley, and we're going to continue talking with Dr. Adi Sharma about strokes and how they're handled at South Nassau Communities Hospital after the short break.
If you would like a podcast of today's program, go to itunes.ncc.edu. Once again, that is itunes.ncc.edu, and click on WHPC.
WHPC.
Welcome back to Your Family's Health. This is Joan Buckley, and we want to welcome back our guest, Adi Shamar, Dr. Adi Shamar, Chief Medical Officer of South Nassau Community Hospital. And we've been talking about strokes, identifying strokes, risk of strokes. But what we haven't been talking is about what happens when you bring a family member to a hospital that is a stroke center, and those are very specific. So with Dr. Shamar, can you just explain a little bit about how to find one that's a stroke center, or now we all know South Nassau's Community Hospital is, but what should the family members expect once they bring their family member super fast to the ER?
So if the symptoms of stroke, it depends on timing of the symptoms of stroke.
Right.
What happens is, like I mentioned earlier, there's a brief window wherein which we can actually provide meaningful intervention for that patient. If let's say, at 10 o'clock in the morning, you're fine, you're feeling well, you're going reading your newspaper, and then all of a sudden you feel your right hand can't move. It's weak and you're not able to move it, and you're worried that you're having a stroke, which you should be, and you get to a stroke center. Well, from that moment that symptom started, let's say 10 a.m., there's a three-hour window for treatment. And what should happen very quickly at any stroke center is, first, the patient should be evaluated by the emergency department triage, identified as a stroke, a potential stroke patient, and then brought quickly into the emergency department treatment area. They should not be sitting in the waiting room. They should then get a very quick CAT scan of the brain to make sure it's not a wet stroke, that it is a dry stroke, because the treatment is only for dry strokes, and it would actually make a wet stroke much worse, and we'll go over why that is. Then once the CAT scan is completed and they identify that there's no bleed, the team that's taking care of you, which may include a neurologist, an emergency physician, as well as the nursing team that's involved in the ED care, they will administer what's called a clot buster drug. Now, before we had phenomenal results with interventions in cardiac catheterizations, which is how we treat heart attacks now, we used to treat heart attacks with this same exact drug. It's a clot buster drug. And for hospitals that don't have that ability to do the catheterizations, they also do the clot buster drug still for heart attacks. So this drug's well-known, well-tested, well-used, long history. And this, what they do is within 3 hours, they give this agent, this drug, into the vein through an intravenous catheter. And what it does is over an hour, it infuses in, and it actually breaks up that clot that was blocking the blood flow to the brain. What the studies have shown is that if this is done in a timely fashion, there's a significant improvement in the symptoms and there's less residual. If you remember, Joe, when we were younger, people who had strokes, we would see them walking with canes, having difficulty speaking, and this would be their lifelong burden after that point. We've been able to reduce a lot of those significant burdens by getting the treatment done quickly.
You know, and I think that's something that people don't always understand, that it doesn't have to be life-changing if we are able to really recognize the fact that it's a big issue and we need to be able to identify it. I remember the TPA, or using the clotbuster drug for cardiac events, and you could watch the rhythm reperfuse, like the blood, you could just see it happening within their, you know, their cardiac strip. Is there some way to monitor it, or is it just by physical exam and just watching for, say, the facial droop to resolve or the strength to come back? How do you monitor it? I know how we do it with cardiac.
That's exactly it, Joan. We have, after the stroke agent is given, patients usually sent to a high-level care unit, either an ICU or a step-down unit where the nursing is a more robust ratio, so that means the nurse can pay more attention to that patient.
Mm.
And they're doing a neuro evaluation, neurologic evaluations on a more frequent basis. And what they're looking for is exactly what you said, resolution of symptoms, improvement of symptoms. Let's say you had numbness or weakness. We measure weakness on a scale of 0 to 5. If you had 5 out of 5, that's full strength. Let's say you came in with 3 out of 5 strength in that arm or leg, and they get to see it's going to go to a 4 or even a 5. So those are signs that the symptoms are resolving, that the agent is working, the TPA, as you mentioned, and those are all good signs. We look for that. And basically the other symptoms would also resolve, whether it's speech or droop, facial droop, or other symptoms, dizziness, et cetera.
Now, what does your stroke center do for people that don't qualify? So there are people that qualify, like you said, the CAT scan can't show a bleed, and that, so they qualify for the clot buster. What, the other people don't just get neglected. What do you do for the other people that have had strokes that don't qualify
right
for the clot buster?
Right. So if you have a bleed, we mentioned the clot buster is basically a blood thinner. Mm-hmm. So if you have a bleed and you have a give somebody a blood thinner, that bleed would get much worse. They don't qualify. For those patients, we do an evaluation whether there's a need for surgery or not. And some of them have small bleeds, which will be self-limited, meaning that they will have no major consequence beyond the initial event, and that hopefully over time there will be resolution of symptoms. So, but there are other bleeds that require certain neurosurgical intervention, so they have to go for brain surgery. Now, for the other patients who come outside the window, now the original window was 0 to 3 hours.
Right.
For patients under a certain age, we've extended that window. The science says we can do from 3 to 4.5 hours. There is what's called the extended window.
Okay.
And certain patients will qualify for that. And then up to 6 hours, we can do an intervention, which is called intraluminal thrombolytics. So what that means is basically similar to the cardiac catheterization, where you go in with the a catheter up to the vessel of the heart. In this process, they go into through a vessel in the brain, and they administer the clot busting drug directly to that vessel. That's a much more complicated procedure. It's done only at high level neurosurgical type sites.
Uh-huh.
It does extend the window to 6 hours, but it's infrequently used only because timing is very difficult at that point. And after 6 hours, there's a concern for bleed. The risk for bleed goes up, whereas the benefit goes down. So because it's a risk-benefit analysis, we don't administer it for those patients. For the patients who have a stroke, and let's say they went to bed one night, they were fine.
Yeah, I was just thinking of that. I was just thinking about that.
Exactly. They woke up in the morning, and now they can't move their left arm. We don't know when those symptoms began.
Yeah.
For those patients, we cannot administer TPA because, again, the risk outweighs the benefit in the sense that the risk for bleed in an unknown time is so much higher that you could actually extend the stroke or make it worse.
You know, this is a very stressful time, too, for the family and the patient themselves. They don't really know what's going on. They're probably very uncomfortable with what's going on. Who's in the discussion when it's not going to be, or well, even if you're going to get the clot buster, who becomes main players in the discussion? Family and neuro, right. I guess?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We normally include family and everyone in all of these types of treatments. It's become the standard of care.
Okay.
So when we first started giving TPA for stroke, we used to get written consent from the patient. So we told the patient and the family members that we're giving a clot buster drug, that there's a risk of bleed, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Somebody would sign a piece of paper saying that I understand the risk associated with this and I accept the risk. However, the science has gotten to the point where we see that the benefit of this treatment is so strong that we should not deny people the access to the treatment by confusing them with paperwork. So mm-hmm. Now it's standard of care, which means that we required to give it the same way we would give oxygen to somebody who is having trouble breathing. We don't ask, hey, can you want oxygen? We just give the treatment.
Right, right.
So we are required to give it. We tell people what we're going to give them so they understand what's happening. If they say to us, I don't want that, or the family member says, I don't want that, we won't administer it. But they will have to sign a piece of paper then at that point saying that they don't want treatment. So it's reversed now.
Oh, wow. I really wasn't aware of that. That's very interesting. And how about afterwards? Like, sometimes people will have a stroke, and sometimes there will be residual effects that they just can't go right back to the home. How does South Nassau Community Hospital kind of facilitate a longer healing process or a rehabilitation for the patients that they've, you know, there's going to be a million different people, a million different stories, a million different reasons why one is better for the other and things. But when it leaves a little bit of damage or leaves a little bit of a residual effect, what is the next step for families?
Right. So typically the next step is a very aggressive rehab.
Okay.
Rehab is short for rehabilitation. The South Nassau is fortunate in that we have a subacute, which means it's an outpatient rehab unit within the institution. So not only can they do aggressive rehab on the floor, our stroke unit floor, and that's the other distinction. Stroke centers typically have stroke units
mm-hmm.
to deliver specialized care for these patients, but we also have the benefit of the what we call our transitional care unit, a TCU for short. And that TCU allows patients who would normally get discharged out to another facility to get continued care in the same hospital that they were in, and that their care team that was involved earlier, let's say the neurologist or the primary care physician, can actually also easily see them in a TCU if there's any need for follow-up. And that's one of the distinctions. Ultimately, long-term care can be done both in, depending on the severity of stroke. So a severe stroke, unfortunately, those patients do require skilled nursing after that point.
Now, it sounds like you have a lot of communication going on. If the family members have questions, like along the whole journey, like who do they call? Do they call the neuro guy? Do they call the unit? Like who's their contact person during all this?
So everybody should be their point of contact.
Anybody and everybody.
That's right. The nurses can absolutely give them information on ongoing care.
Okay.
The neurologist can give them prognostic information as well as to give them a sense of how much of it is it going to be a residual, what will be the long-term rehab plans, et cetera, et cetera. Fortunately, most of our stroke patients do very well when we are able to administer the agent. And they can go home often with home PT.
Wow.
It's amazing. So,
let me tell you, it's a whole new world, right? Every couple of years, something really amazing comes out. And this the way strokes are treated is really, you can watch it fix itself kind of with this clot buster. So I think that's very exciting. But I appreciate you giving all the extra information for things that don't always go according to plan. Like everybody wants the clot buster, but it's not always feasible. Do you have a takeaway message for our audience? Something you want them to know about?
Absolutely. The main message is if you're concerned, if you have any symptoms that seem odd, that you should seek care immediately. If you're not sure, if you're in doubt, go to the emergency department, call for 911 if you are weak and you can't walk, but get that help because it's so time-sensitive, the treatment, that any delay could result in an inability to qualify. And once you don't qualify, we're back to what we had before our TPA was used, which is a lot of hand-holding. So we would rather be able to treat than to simply hold someone's hand.
So call 911, right?
Call 911. Call 911. If you can't get to the hospital. Certainly don't drive yourself to the hospital with a stroke. So.
No. We want to thank our guest, Dr. Sharma from South Nassau's Community Hospital, for being with us today. We want to really thank him for helping us to identify the risks and to recognize signs for a stroke. And we want to thank you, our listening audience, for being here today on Your Family's Health.
This brings an end to another edition of Your Family's Health on 90.3 FM, the voice of Nassau Community College. If you would like a podcast of today's program, go to itunes.ncc.edu and click on WHPC. Joan Buckley is Professor of Nursing at Nassau Community College. Your comments are always welcome at WHPC@ncc.edu. This program was produced at the studios of WHPC 90.3 on the campus of Nassau Community College. Join us again next week for another edition of Your Family's Health.